Welcome to episode 16 of the Serious About Security podcast for Friday, September 14th, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group, Secure Purdue, and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or SIRIUS, at Purdue University. Let me introduce the host of today's podcast. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson, Research Engineer at SIRIUS.
And I'm Mike Hill, CISSP.
So in announcements, this podcast, we have October coming up soon, and that is the National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Here at Purdue, we'll be holding a university-wide event on October 5th. And this event will include a keynote address by the Executive Director of SIRIUS, Dr. Spafford, followed by a presentation by Purdue's new Chief Information Security Officer, David Shaw. We will also have a panel discussion on the promise and peril of social networking, and that will include Dr. Spafford, David Shaw, Purdue's CIO, Jerry McCartney, and Professor Lorraine Kesselberg. After lunch, there'll be two tracks, one on security awareness and the other mostly focused on technical issues. Your podcast host today and many other Greater Lafayette security professionals are making most of the presentations for this event. For more information, go to www.purdue.edu/securepurdue.
The Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group held their monthly meeting yesterday and conducted a workshop using Metasploit. There was an excellent turnout with a total of 15 people in attendance, and everyone seemed to enjoy using the tools. The next meeting is scheduled for Thursday, October 11th.
The Security Seminar Series continues on September 19th with a presentation by Jason Haas from Sandia National Laboratories on Global Revocation in the Intersection Collision Warning Safety Application. It's a mouthful, but I'm sure it's an interesting talk. On September 26th, Mark Brooks from MITRE will be here. The security seminars happen on Wednesdays at 4:30 p.m. in Stewart Center G52 and are broadcast live on Boiler TV in the Greater Lafayette area. These are also made available as podcasts and on YouTube. For more information, go to www.cerias.purdue.edu.
It's a very light podcast as far as security news goes. Firefox released a update, 15.0.1, on September 6th, which contained a fix to the private browsing mode where the browsing was not private. And Microsoft released two updates, no critical updates in September. The two updates they released were for server products and considered important.
The first article today is involving tracking down the Apple UDID breach. On September 3rd, the group Anonymous posted 1,000,001 Apple UDIDs, and they claimed that they had obtained these IDs from an FBI laptop that contained over 12 million UDIDs. So there was a kind of a firestorm of articles coming out talking about what damage could be done from this breach. And in the midst of that, a researcher named David Schuetz began, he downloaded the 1,000,001 files, and he started looking at the data within that file to see if he could find any kind of patterns. And after a day or two of kind of going through it, he made different discoveries. He was able to tie it to an app developer called Bluetoad. And he contacted them and let them know that they may be involved in this breach. And they started an internal investigation, and they were able to match up on 98% of the data that was leaked. They also commented that the data they were able to match up on was only a couple weeks old, versus the group that posted the files initially said that the breach occurred back in March. So right now the evidence looks pretty strongly that it was a data breach at Bluetoad, and it did not involve the FBI, though I keep seeing some conspiracy theories that maybe they were still somehow involved in this. Of course, the FBI has denied it immediately, and when reached for further comment, they said, look at our statement from a week ago. So they are just denying any involvement whatsoever in this event. And the Apple UDID, just to clarify, it is the unique identifier that's 40 characters that cannot be changed on these Apple devices, the iPhones and iPads. So leaking this information, I think of it sort of as like a social security number. It uniquely identifies that device. So that is information that they want to protect. In fact, back in March, Apple started a process where they're going to reject apps that rely on the UDID. So there's already been a process underway for a while to get app developers to move away from using that. I just want to say, first off, kudos to the researcher David Schuetz for kind of looking through and doing some background on this and being able to clarify that, being able to track down the source, with just the data files that were released. There's still a couple things that are a little unclear. One is the CEO of Bluetoad. While they're saying it matches their data, they're not necessarily indicating the full extent of the breach. So they haven't said whether or not it was just the 1 million and one, whether there was truly 12 million or maybe more. And they made a statement that I found a bit disheartening when they were speaking to NBC. They said that their firm would not be contacting individual consumers to notify them that their information had been compromised. Instead, they're leaving it up to the individual publishers to contact readers as they see fit. And Bluetoad develops these apps that I believe allow you to do things like convert PDF to HTML or Flash. So I think they work with several different publishers, and they're saying they'll leave it up to the publishers. And I'm a bit disappointed in that. I would like to have seen them just go straight out and contact people. The advice given in the article, which I disagree with as well, is he said there's many websites where you can check these UDIDs online and just enter your UDID and see if you've been compromised. I don't advise anyone to do that unless you know with 100% certainty the source of that website, because this is an opportunity for people to put up fake websites and say, yeah, give me your UDID. Oh, no, you weren't compromised. And boom, you just got compromised because they now have your UDID. So there's been a lot of information kind of going back and forth on this over the past week and a half or so. So I thought it'd be interesting to bring up, and curious what you guys think.
I think the most interesting part of this was the media and most of the people out there believed Anonymous first. And what I mean by that is most of the articles jumped on board saying, oh, no, Anonymous has broken into an FBI laptop and stolen all this information, and the FBI is keeping this. Why are they keeping it? Then the conspiracy theories came out, right? And we were more willing, and I mean we as a general population and human nature, I guess, we were more willing to believe this rather strange story that the FBI had all this information than we were to believe the actual truth. And even more interesting is, thankfully, we had a smart guy out there who said, that doesn't sound right. And he pulled out his Unix foo, ran a couple commands on the data he had, and said, this doesn't make sense. Thankfully, we have people like that in the research community that are willing to stand up and say, I'm not so sure. And it's interesting that even our source of information that we cite a lot, the Sophos Naked Security blog, jumped on that with an interesting article, basically lambasting the FBI as well, and then had another article later and said, oh, yeah, we were one of them. Oops. Thankfully, this guy, and I'm trying to think of the quote I saw. Basically, he called it a stroke of genius that this guy had discovered this issue. And so, but we were more willing to believe the conspiracy theories. And I think that's, we've had a lot of interesting conspiracy theories over the years. And this was just one more that sounded interesting and somewhat believable. And so everybody kind of jumped on that. So very interesting. At least the FBI stuck by their statement. Turns out that was the case. You're right to point out that the company involved perhaps did not handle it appropriately. I guess we shouldn't expect too much from some companies. That's typically their method of dealing with these things. But Yes, the security researcher who actually looked at the data, that's their job, actually, is to look at mobile device security. And so, thankfully, we do have organizations out there looking at this and kind of questioning what's believed to be true.
And I'll just comment on your statement about the company handling it. I'm kind of mixed on it because on one hand, they did, when the security researcher contacted them, they said, we're doing an internal investigation. Please hold off on making this public, but we want to bring you into it. We want NBC to interview you so that you can talk about how all this unfolded. So I think it was good they stood up and said, yes, we were involved. They could have drugged their feet. They could have let it linger a little longer. So I'm not disappointed in that. In fact, I think they might have even been able to grab some attention by doing it, kind of get their name out there. A lot of things I read said, I never heard of this Blue Toad before. I never heard of them. And now they're tied to this event. So in a way, their name's kind of getting out there, maybe not in a good way. But the other side of it, you know, is kind of where I'm disappointed, where it's kind of like they feel like they did their job by just saying, yeah, we were involved. And if you're really concerned, you go do your homework and figure out if your device was involved in this. So that's the only piece I really I wish they would have kind of came out and said, you need to we're gonna notify anyone that was involved in this that we know was involved and let them know that their data was a part of this.
Well, I agree with Keith, and I thought the same thing. Basically, we trust these hackers who over the government, essentially. And there was a quote in an article that, oh my gosh, hackers lie. You know, I mean, that was a quote that I saw, and I thought it was kind of funny. And that, you know, I mean, yes, they're doing illegal things, and then they lie. I mean, surprise, surprise. So anyway, with that, we'll move on to our next article, which is mine. This is Microsoft is going to be putting out a security update in October that will essentially force the minimum length of certificates in the Windows operating system from desktops to servers to 1024 bits. The update's available now. You can install it if you want. But basically what this will do is, will, if you do not have a certificate that meets the minimum requirements, it will break your stuff. So now 1024 bits is pretty small length right now for certificates anyway. I mean, I'd say it's probably a good minimum. But I mean, Microsoft has been, I'd say, notorious for their backwards compatibility support and things like that, and just kind of holding on and to just old, you know, stuff and not being kind of hesitant to break people's stuff. And I think this is a good move by them. I mean, it's going to upset some people, I'm sure. But basically, what this does is, from their article, Internet Explorer won't allow you to access will not allow access to a website that's secured by a certificate that has a key length less than 1024 bits. Outlook will not encrypt email or allow you to digitally sign email with a certificate with a key length of less than 1024 bits. A lot of Outlook stuff. Basically you can't sign programs with a key with a certificate of less than 1024 bits, with some exceptions. So I think this is a good move by Microsoft, and they're going to actually make it mandatory. They have an option. You can install it now if you want to make sure things don't break or whatever in advance. So I think it's a good thing.
First thing I thought when I came across this story was, this is not the Microsoft I know. They never break things, even when they probably should. And when I worked for a competitor to Microsoft, we broke things all the time and customers hated it. But it was all needed to move the product line forward. And Microsoft never really took that tactic. I mean, if you had software from even MS-DOS days and the early parts of Microsoft, that stuff still runs on Windows 7 today. So to see them come by and say, oh yeah, we're going to put a limitation on these systems, and if you've got a key size less than 10 to 24 bit, or then you're going to have this issue. And that is unheard of from these guys. And that's good, because for the longest time, their approach to security has been very interesting and flawed. But since they have gone on their trustworthy computing initiatives, they have made significant changes, not only in how they design software, how they maintain it, how they code it, the requirements that their programmers go through training on secure programming, and they have a secure development lifecycle process now. They even publish it. I mean, you go to the bookstore and pick up a book on how Microsoft does it. That's how much this company has changed, and this is further proof of that, and I applaud them for that.
I agree. I think this is a great stance for them to take. I think it's very realistic to kind of look at things, and you know, part of what they said was, you know, any certificate less than that bit, number of bits is really insecure in today's world. So it's, to me, it's sort of, you know, the right thing to do. And I think it shows a stance that over time, if, you know, larger keys, like if 2048 eventually, if 1024 becomes much easier to break in a couple years, maybe they bump it up to 2048. So I think this is a good stance for them to have, because things are always changing. And I think showing the ability to react to it is great on their part. But you're right, it's a lot different than the stance they took in the early days.
Okay. I agree, and I think that this is probably a positive thing, and hopefully moving forward they will continue to break things in the name of security.
Okay. Well, that was rather brief. Let's talk more about passwords. One of our favorite topics on this podcast are passwords, weak passwords, password hashes, you name it. We've talked a lot about passwords. And so two interesting articles that are not relevant to the same story, but I found them to be interesting in the sense that they talked about passwords. One of them was an article in The Atlantic, and that article was from, and I'm trying to find her name here, Rachel Swabe. And Rachel Swabe talked about the password fallacy, why our security system is broken and how to fix it. And she recalls a story that we did in a previous podcast about Matt Honan's issue with his account getting hacked, and talked a little bit about the issues that we've known for a long time, in that we have a lot of passwords to remember and we just are not very good at it. And we need those passwords because now we have tied our lives so closely to what we can do online that these passwords become critically important. And the average user can remember maybe a couple, a handful of them at most, use those same passwords on all their accounts, and then suffer from issues such as just having weak passwords that can be easily guessed, or finding that one of the services they use had their password hashes compromised, and then those were used in a brute force attack to recover the original password. And then all their other accounts become potential targets as well. And so the article talks a little about this. This is something that we've talked about many times before. And the interesting thing that she talks about is how do we get around this? How do we solve this problem? And some of the solutions she mentioned were, so for example, on Android phones, for those who have them, if you have the lock screen enabled, you have to draw a pattern on the screen with your finger in order to unlock it. So it's a pattern-based password, if you will, and not a character-based password. There are some other technologies from the biometrics point of view, where while still we know that having a single camera to try to do facial recognition doesn't really work too well, because you could show the picture of somebody's face and fool it. But we are at a point where putting two cameras on a phone is relatively easy, price-wise and technology-wise. And two cameras in the right position give you a stereoscopic view, which is a little more conducive to doing facial recognition, because you give that three-dimensional aspect to it that you don't get with a single camera. And so that might be another future for us. There's many other interesting things out there right now. And so this article kind of highlights a few of those and really kind of highlights the issue of having these issues with all the passwords that we have. The second article is more about how easy it is to break password hashes. And this talks about, also touches on the fact that we have a ton of these accounts. We have a ton of passwords to remember. They cite a study that there's, each user has an average of 25 separate accounts, but uses only 6.5 passwords to protect those accounts. And this is from 2007. 5 years later, that's probably doubled. And maybe the password count is actually halved. So we have this big issue with the number of passwords. But the other interesting thing is we also have extremely fast computing systems now. And this talks specifically about PCs that have graphical process units that actually run at a faster speed than the CPU that runs the computer itself. This gives us great capabilities in gaming, for example, but it also gives us great capabilities in brute forcing a lot of these password hashes. And so for a reasonable amount of money, you can now build a cluster of GPUs that can actually go in and crack password combinations extremely quickly. And one figure they cited that they were able to go through 6.2 billion combinations every second. And that's an old machine, apparently. So the capabilities of just using the specialized hardware for these purposes is very, very interesting. And so we've talked about this before. What's the solution to this? Are passwords going away? The issue highlighted in the Atlantic article talks about the traditional computer that required a password had text entry. You had a keyboard. You had to type in something. It didn't have cameras. It didn't have a touch interface. It may not have had a mouse originally. Now our devices, being tablets and phones, even laptops with touch screens, there's a little more capability there that could also be used to change how we do passwords. So from that perspective, it's pretty interesting. And they cite a few projects where that's actually being done, including the Android system, and there's one for the iOS system, which is a password manager. But we're not there yet, obviously. There's still a lot more research, a lot more products that need to be built, tested in the market, and see how well they work. But I thought these two articles kind of highlight the issue perhaps from two different angles. And they both talk about the same issue. We're in an online world. We have a lot of accounts, but not enough passwords to protect them and not enough memory to be able to store those passwords in our head. Our favorite solution to these typical issues are password managers. In fact, we did a whole podcast episode on password managers. But still, most of the world does not do that, sadly. So from that point of view, I thought these two were interesting articles bringing up our favorite subject of passwords again.
Well, we kind of touched on it last podcast as well with the Dropbox two-factor authentication, and I'm still of the opinion that passwords won't go away until we have some better solution, and it has to be something, probably a central type solution. Basically, I think that passwords are convenient, and that's the problem with the passwords, in that it takes almost no time to create a website that requires a password. It takes a lot of time to create a website that requires other types of authentication. And then the management aspect is also a problem. I mean, people can reset their passwords. You can automate all this stuff, but once you add in that second factor, the concept of them losing it, is a problem. I mean, obviously with something you are, with your fingerprint or whatever, that's something else. But that's even, I think, a little bit more complicated in storing that information and building the authentication around that. So passwords are convenient, and that's kind of part of the problem.
Well, and I'll argue that really, we all kind of give passwords a bad rap, but I don't think anything better has really come along yet. These other technologies are interesting, gesture based on a tablet, for example, But you also can end up in a situation where someone gets your tablet, they can kind of figure out your gesture based on the oil left from your hands. So I think passwords, you know, obviously they're the biggest target. They're the most widely used way to protect accounts, and we've used them for a large number of years. And as Keith already mentioned, computers are getting faster, and the abilities to break those passwords are getting quicker. And there's no reason to believe that it won't continue to evolve that way. What we've ended up in, because of the way the internet just grew, is we have all these online sites that want you to have a username and password. And for convenience, the real convenience, I think, comes in the username. And I'm guilty of this on some sites that I develop as well. It's really convenient to collect an email as a username. But what that ends up doing is if 90% of the sites are doing that, then 90% of the sites are collecting someone's email address that's in common. And due to the fact, it was pointed out in these articles, you know, we can only remember 5 or 6 strong passwords if we're just remembering them on our own. So if I'm not using a safe and I'm creating, you know, 30, 40 online accounts with my email address, I'm likely to reuse those passwords on multiple sites. And because I'm, you know, I'm a human being as well, it's difficult for me to come up with a password that's maybe hard for, there was a quote in there, something about it's hard for a human to remember, but very easy for a computer to break. And I think there's a lot of truth in that, you know. I want to use words that I can remember and just swap out some characters. Well, a lot of people do the same thing, and as they keep doing database dumps, the crackers are figuring out, oh yeah, a lot of people like to use this one word, and they like to substitute O with zero, and it becomes, you know, it gets added to the dictionary. So, you know, as this continues to, you know, this makes the problem grow. But the alternatives right now, as you already mentioned, Keith, you know, we've had web cameras for a while. We don't really yet have laptops that, you know, have two cameras that can capture that 3D image. So you have one image, you put up a picture, boom, you get authenticated. I played around with biometrics. Now it was, geez, I think five years ago, I purchased a laptop new at that time that had the fingerprint reader, and I used it as 2-factor, and it drove me crazy. I finally turned it off because half the time it wouldn't recognize my own fingerprint, you know, and it was annoying. And then if I didn't combine it with a password, I felt like it was weak. Someone could take, you know, have my fingerprint on a piece of tape and log into the computer for me. So, you know, there's obviously vulnerabilities, but no great solution yet has come along. And, you know, I think right now the best we can do is the multi-factor. And again, really advocate the use of a safe. I now generate passwords in my safe. You know, at first I was generating, you know, 10, 12 character passwords. Now I do 25, 30 just because it's easy and I can do it. And I might ramp it up to 50, you know, because it's easy to do with the safe, but getting everyone to go that route is not easy, and that's the challenge.
Well, I think with multi-touch capability on a lot of devices now, and we're going to see that more likely, I think there are possibilities of using that capability as a way, maybe not quite as a biometric, kind of like when you place your fingertips on the thing and it kind of measures the distance. That's one method, but there are other capabilities such as displaying images that you've selected in the past and maybe moving your screen, your finger around the screen to touch those images. And those images can rotate position so that the oil pattern that's left by your fingertips may not be, you know, may not be helpful to somebody trying to pick up your thing and look at it and see if they can guess as what it is. So I think there's some possibilities there. But those possibilities don't yet apply to websites yet. I have seen a system that was being developed where part of their authentication system to get into the website, it would show you images that you had selected previously but put them in different places, and you had to use your mouse to click on those. So there's capability out there. But again, I said that those have to be put in the market. We got to try them out. We got to play with them. And so far, we've not seen that adopted yet so that we can even – get to the point where we have a large population of users who could play with that approach and see if it actually works better for them. So that's really what we need, I think, is for developers to put together something, say, you know what, we're not going to do passwords, or we're going to offer an alternative. And this is the alternative. You know, we're going to try this technique. and just let's get something out there and just start playing with it. Let's start using it, because we're stuck in this bias of, well, passwords have always worked, so let's continue to use them. And I think now we're at a point where we have the capability, both on the web, in our devices, where we can say, you know what, we can do this a little differently. But we have to build those things. We have to put them out there. We have to play with them and try them and let a large population of the average user use them and get feedback. If we don't do that, we can't move forward. We're not going to know what the right way to go is, because we're stuck. We're stuck with passwords. So this is a call for everybody out there. If you're a developer, figure out a new way where we don't have to use passwords in the same way. Let's take advantage of the technology we have, and let's build some cool authentication technology that's unique and different. Let's put it out there. Let's try it. It may fail. So what? Build something better. Let's move forward.
Well, I agree. I would love to see different interesting methods tried. But I think in order for this to get really used, we need to have, we basically, right now we're talking about every single person building their own little method. And I think in order for something to really happen, we need to have a standardized method that everybody can use. You know, we have Facebook, we have Google, we have Dropbox. They all have their own, you know, methods, essentially, for doing this. I mean, I know Dropbox, you can use Google Authenticator and things like that. But everybody's essentially building, reinventing the wheel, I guess, as you could say, to do their two-factor authentication. There's similarities, but it would be nice to have, in order for this to really, I think, take off, the one-man web team should be able to use this sort of authentication, and it should be easy to use and not use passwords, use this other authentication method. And I think until that happens, we're going to stay with passwords, because, as I said, they're convenient from a web development standpoint, not necessarily from an end user standpoint, but from a web development standpoint.
Yeah, and I think what we need is a major adopter to kind of put something out there in beta for us. We need the Google and the Dropbox or the Facebook or Microsofts of the world to say, we've come up with this new way. We're proposing this solution, and we're opening it up for testing. The thing we don't know yet is, as you mentioned, Keith, if we put it out there, yeah, it might fail or it might succeed, but we don't know yet. And that's the thing we got to find out is, here's something we think is secure. It does login authentication differently than passwords. Let's get it out there and let's let people beat up on it and see if there's a major vulnerability that, you know, the developers couldn't foresee. I mean, you just don't know until you get something out there. But I don't think, I don't think there's enough pressure yet on folks to do that. I think even with all the hacking and the database dumps and everything, you know, I think what a lot of at least the large players are doing are saying, well, we're offering more secure ways. You know, you can do two-factor if you so desire. And if you don't, well, you know, it's okay if something happens. You know, it's what are you going to lose? You know, I mean, I don't think it's, you know, I'm not sure there's yet enough incentive to develop that. I mean, I'd love to see something open source, you know, a community come together and say, here's a non-password secure way to authenticate. And I think that would be a great way for it to start. But I don't know who has the motivation to do it.
Well, that's the problem. There's no motivation. Because the people it affects mostly are not developers. It affects the average user. And the average user is not a developer. And they're not willing to put the pressure on in the right way to make it happen. So personally, I think that, you know, if you build a framework, that a library of tools that could use some sort of authentication scheme in a new way, make it open source even better, and that would be an awesome approach. Because at least that way, everybody can look at the code, they can look for flaws, they can say, you know what, I don't like the way it works. I'm going to do something slightly different. I'm going to contribute that back. Make it modular, whatever. I don't know, but at least we got to work on a project at least that gets us started, and hopefully we have contributors from some of these larger organizations that would be willing to say, hey, let's give it a trial. I don't know. that's my pie in the sky sort of approach to it. So we'll hope for the best here, right? But who knows what'll happen out of this.
All right, and with that, we'll wrap it up. I wanted to thank the host, Keith Watson and Mike Hill, as well as Sirius and Secure Purdue. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.